Three, two, one. Confusion over what's happening on a new contract was evident at last night's Borough Assembly meeting. The Alaska Public Employees Association, which represents borough union workers, wanted to meet privately with the Borough Assembly to talk about something they didn't want to discuss in public. But the Assembly opted not to hold a closed session based on the advice of Borough Attorney Gene Hardy. APEA Representative Bob Watts refused to get specific during the public meeting, and when he left, Watts still wouldn't give any details about exactly what's wrong. He did say assembly members think they know what the problem is, but they don't, and he can't talk about it.
I met with the mayor on Monday, explained the problem. She told me one way that I should attempt to resolve the problem. I attempted to resolve the problem through meeting with the assembly, Gene Hardy has discussed this matter with the assembly before we got here and requested that they not allow us to meet with them in executive session.
I'm not really sure what they want to talk about. They haven't discussed it with me.
Borough Mayor Juanita Helms.
Under their interpretations of our ground rules, I would think that would have been the first thing they do, is come talk to us, say what they want to talk to the assembly about, do we object to it being in a public meeting, and going from there. Apparently they don't mind us hearing it, but they don't want us to hear it first.
The Helms administration is negotiating the contract for the borough. Even though the administration would have been invited to the closed session, Helms sees the attempt by the APEA to hold a private meeting as a way to lobby assembly members. And she says that's no different than if she were to try to lobby borough employees.
I think it's absolutely wrong if the mayor went and individually talked to employees. Even if I was very pleasant, it opens up the possibilities of intimidation. And I think the rules are there for a reason, and I'm appalled that a union representative would suggest that that was a valid thing to do. I think it's absolutely wrong for management to go to individual workers and talk to them and negotiate about labor negotiations.
As for where contract talks are now, Helms says they are still negotiating, but the borough has asked for a mediator. The mayor says that's the best way to keep a record of what offers have been made and settled. But the APEA objects to mediation. Bob Watts says he'd much rather continue talking face-to-face, and the borough assembly could learn more that way, too.
In face-to-face negotiations, they could have come to the negotiations and understood. Mediation, like I explained to them, is by law closed. So they will never know the truth of the matter now. Mm-hmm. That's what frustrated us, because we had opened a face-to-face, and all of a sudden they're now shut down mediation and they're closed. We're objecting to mediation because we want the negotiations open. We want face-to-face, which means open negotiations.
And even though they were talking face-to-face with the assembly last night, the APEA representative says it's not the same thing as contract negotiations. Watts says now he'll go back to the union membership and figure out the next plan of action. The current contract remains in effect until a new one is agreed to. The contract talks started last November. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. A major reason that Denali Center's future is in jeopardy is because it doesn't make enough money for capital improvements. When talk of closing the center started in May, the state's Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Myra Munson, offered to help. She told the Hospital Foundation and Denali Center Administration that there may be a way to take better advantage of the state's Medicaid system. And Denali Center has already managed to make a little headway. As of July 1st, the state pays almost $200 a day for each Medicaid patient. That's $35 a day more than Denali Center got for Medicaid patients during the first 6 months of the year. Denali Center Administrator Mark Bertelrude says the new rate includes a component that is to be specifically set aside for planning and construction of a new Denali Center.
So unlike the rest of our rate, which is used for paying salaries and buying supplies and operational kinds of issues, this money is designated exclusively for that purpose. Annually, it will amount to somewhere in the ballpark of between $600,000 and $800,000 a year. That all depends on how many residents we have and how many days we have in our census. But that money this year will allow us to contact some architects, do some initial space planning, look at some of those issues, and into the future, it will help us finalize those drawings, come up with construction documents, and could even be used to actually start building the building.
The center gets the higher Medicaid rate by raising the rent for the Lutheran Hospital and Home Society, which operates Denali Center. The higher rent, close to $1 million annually, means the state will provide more money in the way of Medicaid reimbursement. So Bertelroot says the increase is actually paid by the state through Medicaid.
About 80% of the residents at Denali Center are Medicaid recipients. So the monies that we're charging to the residents are actually paid by the state of Alaska. So any of our costs, not necessarily the rent increase specifically, but any of our costs, if we spend $100 on something, about 80% of that is reimbursed through the state because of the fact that those residents are on the Medicaid system. So with this increase in rent, an $800,000 increase in rent, the role that the state is playing in that is they are reimbursing approximately, and these numbers can change, but it would be approximately 80% of that would be coming directly from the state of Alaska. It would not be coming out of the pockets of the residents themselves.
Bertelroot says for a long time it wasn't clear if rent must be based strictly on the value of the building or if it could include a component for planning. The increase allows for that planning component, but Bertelroot says the question now is how far they can push it. He says it's a brand new idea that he's not aware other facilities have used, but this could open a door for other nursing homes to try it. Bertelroot believes the change may give the boost that's needed to get the community involved in the drive for a new Denali Center. The Hospital Foundation Board wants $10 million to build a new nursing home. They hope to get most of that money from the state legislature. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Because of the interspersion of lands within the federal exterior boundaries, whether it be a refuge or a national park preserve, forest service lands, or wherever, there's a fairly significant amount of inholdings within those boundaries, some of owned by native interests, some owned by the state. And obviously there are no clear boundaries marked out there. There aren't any signs along the boundaries. So it is going to be difficult for the users in many situations to know exactly whose lands they're on. And one way we hope to help clarify this, of course, is to have as good a quality maps as we can available for the user to review before they take the field. This is not a simple undertaking, I understand, but we do hope to have in the project offices of the various agencies fairly small-scale maps where users can go in advance and talk to the federal land managers and determine as best they can where the ownership patterns lie. But this is not a perfect solution by any means because some of the ownerships are fairly small, and it's just going to be very, very difficult for the users at all times to know whose land they're on.
The state budget allocates $7.6 million for pay raises for university employees not represented by a collective bargaining unit. The problem is the university doesn't know who's covered by a union and who is not. According to the University of Alaska Vice President for University Relations, Wendy Redmond, this presents a problem.
Faced with a sort of a dilemma from the legislature with legislative statutory language, which says this pay increase is meant for people who are not in the bargaining unit, we're in the situation of not knowing who's in the bargaining unit or not, other than Prince William Sound Community College, which we know is definitely in the unit. But all of our other faculty, they may or may not ultimately be determined to be in that collective bargaining unit.
Before the university reorganized, Alaska Community College Federation of Teachers represented most of the faculty at the independent community college scattered across Alaska. Now the university is set up differently, and the union fell by the wayside. However, a federal arbitrator says that the university made a mistake and the university will have to deal with the union. That's the dilemma. How to give a pay raise to faculty when some of that faculty may be covered by a collective bargaining unit and therefore not covered by this legislative appropriation. A separate budget item covers negotiated pay raises for union members. The university sent a letter to its approximately 900 faculty members explaining what the university intends to do. Redmond says the Board of Regents decided not to wait to hand out the pay raise.
The decision was made to include in the letter to faculty an explanation of what the dilemma was, as well as a signature page which requires that the faculty members acknowledge that they understand the situation and that if they are later determined to be in a bargaining unit, that it may be necessary for the university to attempt to recoup the funds that were inappropriately paid to them.
So now the faculty has two choices. They can sign the statement that at this point that they are not a member of a collective bargaining unit, but there's a catch. If they sign and later are determined to be represented by the ACCFT, then they might have to pay back the university. Redmond says it's possible that no payback would also be required, but the university wants to cover its bases. Faculty can also choose to not sign the letter, in which case the pay increase will be held by the university until the determination is made. This confusing situation boils down to two different ways the legislature allocates money for pay increases. Redmond says, years ago, this happened all the time.
That's the language that we've always had. In the past, when we had a larger collective bargaining unit, the pay increases for that unit were always handled separately from pay increases for non-organized employees, because they were often different amounts as well.
Wendy Redmond, Vice President for University Relations. I'm John Newstrom.
Three, two, one. Turpin thought he had retired once already when he left Alyeska Pipeline Service Company after 37 years in the oil industry. That was back in 1984, and the state had just taken ownership of the Alaska Railroad from the federal government. When the new railroad corporation began operating in January of 1985, Turpin was at the helm. In the 5 years since then, Turpin says there have been good things and bad. Among the good, keeping the former federal entity free of state subsidy.
We demonstrated that you can take a state entity and operate it successfully as a private enterprise. To me, that's happiness. Another one is, I think our labor contract is certainly one. In fact, that thing has been the envy of railroads all over the lower 48. We have the same contract for all of our unions. And we just have a little appendix on each one that covers any special situations that an individual union will have. And that may not mean a lot to you, but for anyone who has to operate a workforce, having the same contract is just a real fine thing. Your people all have the same benefits. They all have the same grievance procedures. And it's just good for operations. No other railroad in the country has that.
Turpin also was proud of the $66 million spent on new equipment and improvements to the track and roadbed. The railroad has managed to earn $4 million each of the past 5 years, but this year it's costing half that amount to clean up the fuel spill caused by a train derailment south of Fairbanks at Dunbar on Memorial Day. It's the expense of train derailments like that and the one at Crown Point, which Turpin cites as the downside of his years with the railroad.
From the Dunbar oil spill, certainly it was the expense. We did no environmental damage, so I can't really moan that too much. And the expense was true on Crown Point. I don't think we really harmed anyone. Formaldehyde is not that bad a material. But that one was a very expensive item. The derailments all destroyed equipment. Gave us a pretty unfortunate few days when they happened.
Turpin's retirement won't take place until his replacement is found, a job that the Railroad Board of Directors will undertake. Turpin says the biggest job facing his successor will be to keep the railroad independent of the legislature and state management.
The way we are now, we run very much like any other private business. State legislature as a group every year tries to curtail that a little more until one of these days it's going to cease being a railroad. railroad, as we know it today, become a ferry system. And I think it's very important that the successor recognize that danger and do everything he possibly can to keep us independent. I think the state gets a much better railroad.
Turpin says he announced his retirement now so that the board of directors will have plenty of time to look for a successor.
Well, now is a good time to start looking for people. And I think that my big objective is to be out of here before next summer. Let's put it that way. I'd like to spend the summer playing golf and doing other nice things. And I just want to be sure. So this ought to do it.
Turpin says he'll keep busy with volunteer projects and other things that he wants to do. But he will keep his home in Alaska. And he also plans to do a lot of traveling. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Normally at this time of year, the highs are about 72 degrees and the lows are in the lower 50s. By early next week, we could see highs in the 60s and lows in the mid to upper 40s. And for the rest of this week, however, temperatures are going to remain much above normal. We'll have a risk of evening thunderstorms and it's going to be a red-hot firecracker of a 4th of July in Fairbanks.
3-2-1. After House members defeated a constitutional amendment on a second vote Tuesday, everyone went home for a three-day 4th of July break. The session is set to resume this weekend. Governor Steve Cooper still is pressing for action on the subsistence issue. He wants state law to reflect a rural subsistence preference, so the state can retain control of fish and game management, now the job of the federal government on federal lands. Republican Representative Bert Sharp of Fairbanks refuses to support the governor's proposed solution. He's a member of the House minority that has enough no votes to keep the amendment from passing. And Sharp says the special session has accomplished one thing.
I think it's finally been accepted by almost everyone that there's not going to be a constitutional amendment. And then that was not accepted, unfortunately, at the end of the regular session, even though there had been two votes on it during the regular session. But now we've had two more on the same issue. One thing about, at least the Senate had to vote this time, and a lot of exchange happened there. So my personal opinion is I think they've politically beat up on everybody that they can, and I think all the loose apples in the tree are down. I don't see them getting four or five more, no matter where they're from, because we've discussed the issues. Everyone understands all the ramifications. All the boogeymans have been trotted out in front of us, and I think that's done with. Now we've got to try to determine if there's any other action we can take.
Sharp supports a court challenge to the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, the federal law that requires a rural subsistence preference. Fairbanks Representative Mark Boyer, a Democrat, has also voted against a constitutional amendment, but he thinks a court challenge would take too long to resolve things.
So I was looking for any way that I could become a yes vote, and I wasn't shy about telling it. I didn't favor institutionalizing discrimination in an amendment form, but I was looking, and I was working with factions to see if we could come up with something, but it just wasn't there. As you get closer to being able to do something that I could vote for and that five or six others could vote for, you lost the support of the other folks. It's, you know, people drop out on both ends depending on how you push it. You can't improve the thing easily anyway without losing support of folks. And frankly, the Native leadership made it very, very clear to us that their subsistence needs and priorities will be taken care of on federal lands. They'll also be taken care of on state lands. They will have, by residency, under the Cutler decision, the Tier 2 priority by locale. So when they have a shortage that requires that you can't even meet the broader subsistence needs of Alaskans, all Alaskans in an area, the Tier 2 regulations come in state lands, and they can more narrowly restrict it to the people of a particular area. So they know what that means, and they know that it's going to mean rural. It's kind of like local hire. It's real local, and it gets into your own backyard, and your subsistence needs are going to be protected. So given that, why should they compromise for something that they don't want? And that's made And of course, the other side is, you know, similarly positioned, so I don't see us moving.
Even though he's in a minority among House Democrats, Boyer says it's a political issue for him because people here are overwhelmingly opposed to a constitutional amendment. Both Sharp and Boyer say all the arguments for the different solutions have been heard in Juneau, and there's little left to talk about. Whatever the governor comes up with this weekend will have to be something new. According to Boyer, the president of the Senate says if they aren't done by late Sunday, they'll all just go home. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Near-record-setting heat in the state's interior is over. Alaska Interagency Fire Information Center spokesperson Sue Mitchell hopes the same is true of Alaska's wildfires.
Well, it looks at this point as if the worst is over. We're cautiously optimistic, I guess, would be the word to use. We're now able to go on the offensive rather than being on the defensive all the time.
Area fires all saw some weekend rain, but one fire that did spread quite a bit over the weekend is the one near Beaver. Mitchell said Sunday afternoon that had grown to 65,000 acres in a run to the east. Mitchell says firefighters were building line along the south side there and planned to burn out. The Cassier Creek fire was being held at the south end to protect structures. A fire at Pedro Dome was considered contained by Saturday night. And in Tok, Mitchell said Sunday, things were closer to being under control.
Tok was, the fire was laying down today. It was cooler, cloudy. The lowest relative humidity predicted to be about 40%. Weather's buying us time, generally speaking, and we're going to use it to our best advantage, try and get a handle on that. The Tok fire, they said about 6 more miles of line, and they would consider Tok safe, and they thought they would get that done tonight.
Mitchell says more fires did break out over the weekend, but not at the rate that they had during the week. Some 2,100 firefighters are on the job in Alaska now. Mitchell says some more are still trickling in, but the state hasn't ordered any additional help. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Fire Information Officer Frank Carroll says the size of the fire near Beaver more than tripled over the weekend. Carroll says the acreage is still an estimate, but hopefully a closer estimate.
It's a very remote fire in the middle of the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge. And the people that were on the ground using just their eyeballs and guesstimates were guessing at the acreage. Once we started to get fairly good infrared photography of the fire, we've been able to be much more accurate in the acreage calculations. But even so, all the pictures haven't been taken and the acreage hasn't been completely plotted yet, but we believe that it's about 200,000 acres.
Carroll says firefighters working on the south and northeast perimeters of the blaze report no problems. Some areas around that fire aren't actively being fought, but Carroll says that's not the main reason it has spread so much.
The Beaver fire has grown as rapidly as it has for several reasons. The biggest reason was the weather at the time, high temperatures, low humidities, dry fuels. If we would have had many firefighters in the area, we might have been able to take some effective action on it, but it's not worthwhile for firefighters to fight a fire like that that's in essence threatening nothing and doing no major harm to anyone or any resources. And so it's one of those calls you have to make when you prioritize fires, which ones you're going to fight. And we think we've picked the really important ones to fight, including part of the Beaver fire.
As some fires get under control, Carroll says firefighters may be relocated to battle other blazes. That could happen as things quiet down at Pedro Dome, just outside of Fairbanks. Carroll says that situation has greatly improved.
It's a long process to get to actually formally calling a fire out, so Pedro Dome will not be called out for several more days. But it is controlled, and it is contained and controlled, and we feel very comfortable about it. It's very muddy and very wet in the Pedro Dome area.
Another fire near Fairbanks at Cassier Creek hasn't grown much beyond an estimated 3,000 acres. Carroll says firefighters are making steady progress there.
There's about 80 firefighters altogether, and it did burn to within 200 yards of structures, but everything's safe and sound now.
although the number of wildfires reached more than 200 in Alaska, Carroll says more than 30 fires are out, and the number of new fires each day continues to decrease.
The overall weather situation that we predict is that things are improving every day. Certainly the short-term fire problem has improved dramatically, and if we continue to get rain over the next several days, the long-term problem will improve. The reason we've had fewer new fires each day is we've had fewer lightning strikes. We were receiving over 3,000 lightning strikes a day, and that amount of strikes has steadily declined. So things are improving all around.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Once the House pulled the plug on the session, the Senate quickly adjourned also, ending 2 weeks of activity at an estimated cost of $300,000 that produced exactly one thing, another commission. Senate President Tim Kelly's measure calling for a subsistence review panel was the only bill to pass both houses. Kelly was not impressed with his Republican colleagues in the House or their stubborn opposition to amending the Constitution.
Well, I'm not going to attribute it to deep thinking.
Several lawmakers referred to gubernatorial politics as one of the complicating factors of the session. Arlister Jaluski, the front-running candidate to replace Steve Cooper, tied her position firmly to the constitutional amendment. One of her opponents is Rick Halford, who fought heavily against that plan, both in the Senate and behind the scenes with the House minority. No one could say for sure that votes were changed on subsistence because of loyalty to one candidate or another, but Representative Gene Kabina said if it weren't for those tensions, the amendment would have passed. From Kelly's point of view, the political fallout from this session is clear, and he thinks it's headed for the House minority.
We'll see how many of those Republicans come back next year. You know, the reality is that in a representative democracy like ours, you are, in a final analysis, responsible to your constituencies. I believe that the constituencies of most of the Republicans would have preferred a solution to this problem. And I think that if some of the opponents that some of those candidates have make this an issue in the August-November elections, I think some of the incumbents are going to be in trouble.
As they headed out of town, some lawmakers vowed they would be back, probably in late August, to deal with the issue again. September 1st is the deadline for getting another issue on the November ballot. Governor Cooper says he might call them back, but not anytime soon, and only if the commitment to do something next time is absolute. In the meantime, he's got other things to worry about, including a potentially huge shortfall in the budget for this fiscal year.
The next step is I have to take some action on the budget. Life goes on.
In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Over the last 4 months, the Good Sense Recycling Group collected 30 tons of material at its recycling stations around Fairbanks. 25 tons of that was glass. But the local recycling center that was accepting that glass cannot afford to any longer. Good Sense co-founder Marty Peel says that decision prompted the Good Sense group to decide to shut down the shelters.
We'll pull them so that people aren't confused and don't leave materials because we can no longer handle them until we can find a place to take glass and plastic. A gravel pit, for instance, might be able to use the glass in a roadbed. And there are some uses for plastic that we need to work on. If we cannot find a place to take those things, we could reopen the shelters for the collection of tin cans and aluminum cans only. But we need to sort of break the pattern now of bringing glass and plastic to the shelters, at least for now, till we can find a market for them.
Peel says Sunday is the last day to take your glass, plastic, aluminum, and paper to the Good Sense Recycling drop-off stations. But the decision to close may have been made anyway. Peel says the volunteer recycling effort has reached the point where it's going to take more than volunteers to keep things going.
We ran the pilot project with volunteer coordination and volunteer haulers moving those tons of things to Sandy's. We need at this point either to find funding for a coordinator to keep volunteers working steadily or for a driver who can be responsible for driving the truck which the Chino River Run donated to us, the Fairbanks Rotary Club. If we have glass and plastic to move, we need a driver. If we're moving aluminum only, we can probably pay for that from proceeds from the aluminum, and we won't need a driver. But we're facing that decision anyway. If we stop collecting glass, we need to close the shelters to break the patterns temporarily. So we were at a decision. We were at a turning point.
The Good Sense Group is a committee of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center, and Peel says it's not going away, and neither is recycling. They now plan to build on what they've learned and are still learning. Tonight they'll meet with the man who runs the Anchorage Recycling Center. They want anyone interested in the future of Good Sense and recycling to get together tonight with Tom Turner at the Borough Building. For now, it's a matter of dealing with the cost of recycling glass. Even though transportation costs to get the glass from Fairbanks to Anchorage were donated, Peel says it still costs more to process the glass than the $7 a barrel that Sandy's Recycling Center was getting for it in Anchorage. And Peel says the Anchorage Recycling Center even loses money when it ships the glass out of state. But as Peel's statistics show, the market for glass recycling may be the biggest one.
And it's specifically the glass that was draining Sandy's resources because she loses money processing that. We were responsible for about 6% of the materials that Sandy was shipping down to the Anchorage Recycling Center total, but we were responsible for generating about half of the glass volume she was dealing with, and that was straining her resources. In other words, we were much more successful than we ever anticipated being.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I think to be very effective, you have to at least spend 6 months in Juneau. And for me to pull my girls out of school, which they wouldn't stand for, and my wife is a professional, she's got her career to think of, it just wouldn't be fair to them. So I've decided to drop out and spend my time with my family. My family says, no, don't run, and I have to listen to them.
3-2-1. Governor Cooper says his vetoes reflect a balancing act, calling for sacrifices from everyone.
If a great clamor is raised from every interest group, we will know that that particular objective has been met.
The clamor has already started here with the elimination of the Fairbanks Block Grant, more than $500,000 divided among social service agencies. Arctic Alliance Chairman Rick Tessendore, who represents several agencies, feels the vetoes could be devastating.
My initial response was to look at the capital budget and see that a public health center was vetoed, and I believe that has been represented by the community as a broad-based constituency. There are people without resources and without access to any health care at all now, and this facility that has been vetoed is falling down around the ears of the people who are taking part and working in that facility. And then to see that the social services block grant, which provides funding for a number of different human service groups in this community, that not only provides services to this community, but to those outlying areas that have nowhere else to go. We're a hub for social services and human services here, and we must reestablish some priorities that deal with people.
Recipients of that block grant include the Fairbanks Crisis Line, Literacy Council, Alaska Legal Services, Women in Crisis Counseling, Breadline, and the Resource Center for Parents and Children. Also, the Salvation Army, which lost some other grants earmarked for its program. In all, 15 agencies will lose some funding through the block grant. Tessendore thinks the unexpected cuts could be life-threatening for some. Anchorage and Fairbanks are the only cities that receive those block grants. Governor Cooper noted in his veto message that the cut was intended so that those communities will do more for themselves.
For several years now, the larger cities, at least in this state, have been able to provide a pretty good level of services by simply relying on the state to provide the money. That will be much more difficult after this veto exercise.
Actually, as far as the Fairbanks North Star Borough goes, we've made ourselves incapable of carrying more of the ball.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Juanita Helms.
We put ourselves in a tax cap situation, so as there's cuts on the state level, we just cut services.
Mayor Helms says the governor's vetoes will translate into some $1.5 million in cuts from the borough's budget. School debt reimbursement is the biggest chunk of that, since the governor cut that funding by 10%. The University of Alaska system took a 2% cut statewide. That 2% cut applies to UAF. Some capital projects were spared, though. Much of the money for the Healy Coal Project remains in the budget. The governor did not cut funding for the UAF Natural Sciences Building. Some university maintenance projects were left in the budget, others were cut. and the Borough School District still has the money for a new Fort Wainwright Elementary School. Some other capital projects for schools did not make it past the governor's veto pen. Even with the vetoes, the state budget is about the same as last year. The governor says these changes were necessary because the legislature overspent and oil prices are substantially lower than expected, down about $2 a barrel. Cooper says he tried to preserve budgets for education and economic development, but funding for things like design of an Aurora Visitor Center, restoration of the riverboat Nanana, and Main Street's riverfront effort were all veto victims. Rick Tessendore is already planning to get the community taking action over the loss of funding for service programs.
So we're going to have to mobilize and, you know, really look hard at what this is and what the message is from our government. And I would hope that the local community can find alternatives to this kind of severe cut in human services.
The governor says if necessary, the legislature can come back in January and cut more or balance the budget with reserves. And some legislators are already talking about possible overrides. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. A couple of things changed during the course of the week. Good Sense co-founder Marty Peel says Sandy's Recycling Center will continue accepting glass and plastic, but she doesn't want the volume to grow at this point. So the Good Sense group will keep the drop-off shelters in Esther and at the Borough Office Building as long as volunteers can help out. Other shelters at College Mall, Foodland, and Weller will close until they can get more volunteer help to take the material to the Recycling Center. Recycling fans here talked about options at a Wednesday night meeting, a meeting which Anchorage Recycling Center's Tom Turner attended. Turner says a lot of positive things came up at that meeting. Enthusiasm for recycling may be there, but Turner says financially, it's a risky business.
The financial benefit for recycling is kind of a catch-22 insofar as that everyone considers that the value of the product should pay for the entire system, and then private sector gets involved based on the value of that product. Well, anything that's highly valuable, like aluminum, that takes place. What you're getting into, though, is we need to start recycling our lower-grade items, glass, paper products, plastic, that have a high sort and processing cost. And so it's somewhat marginal for private sector to be in that. But when you look at the cost benefits to the community, right now it costs $30 a ton on what the assembly set of price should be to put something in the landfill, and you pay for all your dumpster services through your taxes. If you looked at the true cost of what a landfill is in Fairbanks, it's probably going to run you $60 to $100 a ton. In 5 years, you're not going to have a landfill. The EPA is coming out with new regulations that require liners and leachate systems and closure funds. Plus, there's a huge liability that the borough of Fairbanks, North Star Borough, has to carry. And so when you start looking at this larger picture, it's very cost-effective for community recycle.
Turner says the Fairbanks recycling business is going through growing pains right now. It's made progress, rapid progress in some cases, and now the question is, what else should happen here? Turner says it's not just a matter of reducing trash going into the landfill either. A larger issue is resources. The market for recyclable materials still isn't as great as the market for raw resources.
It's hard to sell paper and glass when they compete with subsidized resources like tree cutting. As long as they're going to pay to cut trees, it's going to be hard for any recycler to sell recycled paper. Any paper company or fiber company is going to go and get raw material that he can get cheaper because the government pays to subsidize that versus going ahead and having to buy product that recyclers have put too much money in to get it down there because that's what it costs to move it. So as long as they can get cheap resources, they're not going to use recycled product, and the planet's continuing going to go down the tubes.
Turner says the Good Sense Group is doing a good job for Fairbanks, but it's hard work. Co-founder Marty Peel says community members who want to support recycling can volunteer to take the materials to recycling centers, take your own recyclables to centers yourself, and write to state and local government officials about paying to support the effort. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
This is an enormous problem, really diverse, lots of complex interconnecting factors, health needs, mental health needs, shelter needs, you know, cultural issues, having parents and teenagers. It's really easy to feel overwhelmed by it, and it's really easy to feel hopeless and despairing. And I think that's something we run into continuously, is keeping our focus, keeping working on it, feeling a sense of accomplishment, feeling like we are able to do something with just a problem of such magnitude. How can we get kids involved? We don't want to say, here's what we want to do, will you help us do it? We want to say, what do you think would be useful? How can we help you do it? So I'm putting the word out to kids, to parents, to business owners, to community members. This is our goal. We have some ideas, but we need a lot more input about how to accomplish this.
3, 2, 1. The Alaska Outdoor Council is one of the plaintiffs in the federal lawsuit challenging ANILCA. Outdoor Council members just scored a victory for their effort by convincing the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly to file a friend of the court brief supporting them in opposition to the federal law. Council President Bud Burris says ANILCA usurps states' rights. Tanana Chiefs Conference Chairman Mitch Dementif agrees that letting the federal government have a role in subsistence management here isn't a good idea, but Dementif supports ANILCA, saying it wasn't until that law was passed in 1980 that game populations began to improve in the interior.
It allowed us to go into a sound conservation program. With this and the help of several mild winters in a row, we were able to rebuild the resources in the interior. And we've done that in the 1980s. We've done that with ANILCA and, for the most part of the decade, a state subsistence law which reflects ANILCA in effect. And we've been able to build our resources until we now are beginning to get healthy populations. We are not there yet.
Dementif calls federal regulations worrisome, saying they just scratch the surface of what we can expect with the federal government involved. He still hopes to see the state legislature get together and get a constitutional amendment on the ballot this fall. The Outdoor Council's Bud Burris has been one of the leading opponents of a constitutional amendment, and he doesn't agree that ANILCA is responsible for better game management in some areas. He says that happened before 1980. Burris says amending the state constitution would just make a bad law permanent, complaining about a rural preference based on residency.
If Donald Trump were to move into Nenana, and I assume Mitch still lives in Nenana, under the past rules, if he'd lived there a year, he would be a qualified subsistence user. Now, of course, he may be broke and really need it by then, the way things are going. But and this is the way the law has been adjudicated. And this is because of the constraints put on by ANILCA. ANILCA has said, and the judges have ruled, that we cannot use need as a factor for setting up any criteria on subsistence under ANILCA.
Burris says his group doesn't want the federal government to take over any part of game management either, but the solution to that is to get the governor to join the challenge.
The council has been accused of not really caring or not trying to do anything about to keep the feds from coming in and taking over management. But we have a whole list of items that shows that clearly that we have tried to keep the feds from taking over. The governor has had many options that he could follow to keep the federal people out, and he's not chosen to do so.
Dementif believes the groups can all work together to solve the problem, which will become much more complicated unless something is done.
Were I a member of AFN, I would recommend that Sam McDowell be the AFN Citizen of the Year. Unfortunately, I'm not a member of AFN. I hope somebody does, because what he has allowed us to do by challenging that lawsuit right now, it looks to me like all Alaskans are subsistence users. I do not know of any population, moose, caribou, or otherwise, that can withstand the harvest of all of us Alaskans, which means that if every Alaskan is a subsistence user, that we're going to have to go to Tier 2 hunts. The traditional and customary dependence on those resources is going to become the kicking factor. And it looks to me like that the most of the people who have a traditional and customary dependence on Alaskan resources are Alaska Native people. And I think this is the closest to what our overall position was, the Native community, prior to the 1980 compromise, which is Native preference for on subsistence.
Both the Outdoor Council and Tanana Chiefs agree that state management is the best thing. Dementif says outside forces have Alaskans fighting for the resources and believes that they're going to steal the crumbs if we don't resolve it. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Midwives, 7/17/90. Coming down in 3, 2. Coming down in 3, 2. Coming down in 3, 2, 1. The proposals call for midwives to have a doctor available to back them up, to perform 25 births per year in order to be licensed, and to have their clients see a doctor more than once during their pregnancies. Now, while these may sound like reasonable guidelines for most places, local midwives say they just don't apply to the small-town birth professionals who work in Alaska. Vicki Penwell practices at the Alaska Family Health and Birth Center in Fairbanks, one of the busiest alternative birth facilities in Alaska. She's concerned that midwives haven't had enough voice in the proposed regulations.
They are going to be supposedly implemented without any kind of an advisory board of midwives themselves, or consumers of midwifery, either one.
Wendy Thon is the maternal and adolescent program nurse consultant for the Department of Health and Social Services. She says the department has been trying to put regulations together since midwifery was first legalized in Alaska in 1985. A working group of 3 lay midwives, 1 physician, and 1 certified nurse midwife worked for more than a year to hammer out recommended regulations.
And then I think there was a physician consultant that was on contract with the state, with the division at that time doing other things, who gave some input, and then giving that to the attorney to draft the regulations and put them in correct format and review statutes, et cetera, that process took about a year's period of time. And then, and going and taking those regulations that have now been formatted correctly, et cetera, on up to the commissioner and to the attorney general's office, now they're going for the final public comment.
Vicki Penwell was one of the 5 people on that original working group. She says the Midwives Association of Alaska is always in favor of regulations and keeping a high standard for their profession, but she's disappointed in the end product of the process.
They were different, substantially different, and they substantially, the midwives felt that they would restrict their trade and weren't reasonable.
Health and Human Services' Wendy Thon is the person reading and sorting the comments that have come in so far. She says they're coming in from all over the state, but mostly from communities on the road system and Juneau.
And we've received comments from people who have had home births, physicians, lay midwives, nurses, public health nurses.
Thon says the comments are showing that midwives are concerned about the required quota of 25 births per year. Lay midwife Dana Everson agrees that's the most restrictive of the proposals that may mean some of the 20 or so lay midwives in Alaska would have to close their businesses.
Some choose to practice in small rural communities and choose to have a smaller practice.
Everson works with Penwell at their nonprofit clinic in Fairbanks. She says even some doctors in Alaska don't deliver 25 babies per year.
Well, we are one of the busiest practices in the state, probably. We do somewhere between 60 and 80 a year. But there's 3 midwives working here, too. So if you divide that by 3, we wouldn't maybe each in 1 year, if we only did 60, 65. See, because we work in teams, we work as a group practice. And many midwives that work, like in Kenai, there aren't that many babies being born in small towns. Even the doctors don't deliver 25. The other thing about it that's unreasonable is that no other practitioner delivering babies is required, a minimum number, like certified nurse midwives, family practice doctors, obstetricians. They're not required that.
Written comments on the regulations should be addressed to Wendy Thon at the Department of Health and Social Services in Anchorage and be postmarked by July 20th. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Robin Martin.
Governor Cuts 4, United Way, produced for Monday, July 23rd, 1990. Coming down in 3, 2, 1. The chambers will be packed at tonight's city council meeting. The subject of the governor's veto of the municipal block grant is not even on the agenda, but representatives from the United Way, the Arctic Alliance for People, and many local social service groups will be there to talk about it. Among other things, the governor cut $537,000 that was slated to go to 16 nonprofit groups in Fairbanks. He wants Fairbanks and Anchorage to pay for the services and community groups in their own cities, instead of asking for state funding. And the social service groups have now put the ball in the city council's court. Serving the ball first is United Way, which is sending it over the net with a sweetener.
The United Way Board of Directors at their meeting on Tuesday had made an offer to the city of Fairbanks that if they would match our $38,743 from our contingency fund, that we would then make that available to the 16 agencies who were slated to receive city block grant funding.
That's Debbie Tillsworth, Executive Director of United Way of the Tanana Valley. She says the offer still stands, even though the governor has tentatively put back half the money he cut. Tillsworth and other charity directors will be able to address the city council for a short time at the beginning of the meeting tonight.
Our offer is contingent upon the city picking up the other half of that, and we feel that together, you know, that will make $77,486 available then to those 16 agencies. And we do see it as a drop in the bucket, but something that would at least allow them to keep their doors open by a little time for them to look for alternate sources of funding.
The money from United Way represents 80% of their contingency fund, which is used to cover emergency requests from local nonprofit groups. The board of directors of United Way felt the cuts from Governor Cooper's veto constitute enough of an emergency. City Council members will be able to discuss meeting United Way's offer under Council Member Comments at the end of their agenda, but they won't be able to pass any action until a future meeting unless they all agree to act tonight. For KUAC Local News, I'm Robin Martin.
We're taking a look at the entire state of Alaska and looking at where we think ideal boundaries would be if the entire state were divided into boroughs. Now, we're not advocating borough formation. We're just using this as a tool or a guideline so that in the future, if an area, say if the borough were to come to the department and request annexation, we could then take a look at the model boundaries that have been approved for this area, and if the area they're requesting to annex is within the model boundaries, then that eliminates a lot of the problems and discussion. But we feel at some point in time, if those areas are going to be in a borough, we feel that the ties, both social, economic, cultural, are stronger to the Fairbanks North Star borough than they would be to any other borough that is in their area or might form in their area.
Hammering away at the idea of declining oil revenues, Governor Cooper defended his $325 million in vetoes to a room full of reporters.
Legally, we have to balance the budget in Alaska. That's a very interesting trick, since we have no earthly idea what our revenues are going to be.
The governor says he chose Fairbanks and Anchorage for the heaviest cuts because only those two cities have had special appropriations in the form of block grants, and they've been getting the special attention for years.
It isn't fair to the other cities in the state of Alaska who have to tax their citizens in order to provide the same services.
Cooper says already the cuts are having the desired effect. Municipal governments in Fairbanks and Anchorage are looking for ways to pick up responsibility for their services. Cooper says he's been working toward pushing the burden back on the cities for his whole administration. It was not intended to look like a risky move of a lame duck governor. Still, many officials suspect the timing of the vetoes. He made them last Wednesday, just a few days after the adjournment of the special session, which failed to generate a constitutional amendment on subsistence. It was voted down by many urban legislators, mostly from Anchorage and Fairbanks. The vetoes also came too late for municipalities to budget for the fiscal year. But Cooper says he was not retaliating for any past politics, and everyone was hurt equally by the vetoes. He made them late because the subsistence issue kept him and his staff busy 20 hours a day during the special session, he said. And when it was over, they were pushed up against a July 11th deadline to approve the budget.
Personally, it was a very, very difficult decision for me. It was probably the single hardest decision that I've made, and I don't feel very sanctimonious about it.
The block grants for Fairbanks and Anchorage are not protected or authorized by statute. That's why Governor Cooper could cut them while leaving in other, less controversial funding, such as entitlement programs or bargained salaries. And he said over and over how this kind of cut is not a one-time thing, that cities must pay for their services.
When you get right down to it here, what you've got is the state's two largest communities that basically don't want to tax themselves. That's what it comes down to.
The governor came very close to using the I word, income tax. He did answer affirmatively when a reporter asked him if income tax was a possibility. For KUAC Local News, I'm Robin Martin.
Essentially, the objective of the trip is to get everyone together and work out some mutual problems that we have in dealing with mining in the Wild and Scenic River system.
That's Bob Burritt, manager of the Bureau of Land Management's TOC office.
We feel as though that better communications amongst us would lead to fewer conflicts or maybe confusion in the future about business that's conducted out on the in the 40 mile.
BLM has invited a representative of the Washington, D.C.-based environmental group, American Rivers, to come on the raft trip. Also, a representative from the Northern Alaska Environmental Center here in Fairbanks, and Steve Burrell of the Alaska Miners Association.
Well, my wife told me to ask me if I thought it was safe. I'm not real concerned. I can swim pretty well.
This spring, the 40 Mile River appeared on American Rivers' annual list of endangered rivers in America. They're concerned about a placer miner named David Likens, who is looking for gold in the section of the 40 Mile designated scenic by the federal government. Randy Shostak, spokesman for the environmental group, says that Likens is using a new dredge known as the New Zealand dredge.
This is amazing that this could possibly take place within a wild and scenic river corridor. I mean, this is one of the country's most beautiful rivers. To get into the system, it has to be an outstanding river.
But mining is one of the more traditional uses of the 40 Mile River, according to Burritt, who is a national resources specialist from the TOC office of BLM. When Congress designated the 40 Mile a national wild and scenic river, there was an environmental impact statement prepared for that designation, and mining was identified as a primary component in that river system, basically a resource from a historical standpoint, he says, and an ongoing industry. David Likens is working on his mine right now and unavailable for comment on this story. He's located about 20 river miles below the bridge over the Taylor Highway, about 3 miles from the Alaska-Canada border. The rafting group will stop at Likens' mine on their trip. AMA's Burrell says it seems that BLM's plan to find common ground may work.
I'm going on for information to learn from them what their real concerns are. I'm going to be curious to see what these people feel is being done wrongly.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Robin Martin.
That's the only place where we have sun, the sun and darkness, well, the sun and magnetic field configuration, right. So we will be down there in September to carry out these experiments.
What we do is we release this material in the dark, and the neutral gas flows across the magnetic field lines and the weak plasma that already exists there. And then it should self-ionize. And we will see the ions when they come up into the sunlight spiraling along the magnetic field lines. Anyway, we hope to make a major contribution to plasma physics and perhaps to the formation, you know, a theory of the formation of the solar system.
The first calls for a general sales tax on most everything except rent, food, and medicine. The 2% tax is estimated to raise an extra $20 million a year in revenue. Besides the general tax, a 6% alcohol tax was also introduced. Most of those revenues would be dedicated to fighting alcohol abuse. The third proposal calls for retailers to levy a 4-cent per gallon gas and diesel tax. The money from that would go toward air quality programs. In past years, similar tax plans were proposed but never passed. The governor's recent budget cuts may change that. Without the millions that normally come from the state, members of the assembly, the mayor, and the voters are now realizing they will have to find some creative ways to raise money or live without some important services. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Murabito.
Three,
3-2-1. Until the agencies can come up with a plan for long-term funding prospects, Rick Tessendore of the Arctic Alliance for People wants to buy some time. He and Debbie Tillsworth of the United Way asked the City Council to match the United Way's challenge. That would mean at least $77,000 more this year. Tessendore says that money would at least help the agencies get through the short-term problem.
We would like you to match the United Way's contribution, and we'd also like to see you look for some funding mechanism, either a new or an increase of some tax that might offset the $268,000 that still remains to be had to provide these services until June 91. That gives us a full year of transition planning and working in our community to educate the public at large as to the importance of these services and how they are currently being handled.
Governor Cooper gave the social service groups some breathing room last week when he agreed to fund them for 6 more months, but he continues to say that Fairbanks must be prepared to pay its own way as state funding sources dry up. He may have picked a poor example, though, when he cut the block grant money, funds that the city never provided to begin with. The agencies have always looked to the state for that money. The city was used as an agency to disperse it. Mayor Jim Nordahl is not so sure the city should be the one to help out now.
If that's the last resort rather than see everything tumble, I think that's, you know, that perhaps it ought to be done. It would have to be done on a one-shot basis with some clear plan for the future as to how this is going to be accomplished or how these agencies are going to be funded, because I don't think it's the city's responsibility to fund social service agencies for the entire community, especially when it has never actually funded those services. And there are other city services which the city has traditionally performed that are being cut back and reduced and are not meeting, you know, not meeting the citizens' needs. So, I think we have to sort that out.
Nordahl says if local government should participate in this sort of funding, the source would more likely be the borough. City Council member Jim Hayes says he's been talking with borough assembly members about possibly joining the city to match the United Way's challenge, but he's still looking for a source of funds from the city side of things. He hasn't found one yet, but he does think it's something the city should address.
I think that the community in general ought to come together on this and help, regardless of, I mean, you know, it's easy to say, well, it's not our, you know, it ought to be the state or it ought to be this. I think it ought to be a community-wide project, and I think if we've got the money to do it, especially with the borough, I'm not in favor of it if the city's just going to cough it up. Well, we don't have the $30,000 anyway, but even if we did, I still think that it should be a joint effort.
City Council members did not address the United Way's request during the meeting, and there may not be anything to discuss the way city finances stand currently. City Manager Bob Wolting says at the present time, the city is about $5,000 short of a balanced budget.
It's a beautiful request, but I don't know where in the world we'd match it from.
The social service agencies don't plan to leave the request on the city's doorstep alone. Rick Tessendore says they'll also ask the Fairbanks North Star Borough for help at the assembly meeting later this week. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3-2-1. Dr. Gunter Ploeger says the hope for his country is an all-German freely elected government by January 1st. But he says just 1 year ago, no one would have believed what has taken place in Germany and Eastern Europe so quickly. In fact, it's because of the rapid changes that Ploeger's here. The ambassador to Germany was scheduled to make the trip, but had to stay in Washington. So Ploeger, as the minister counselor for Germany, came instead. After giving chamber members a review of the road leading to reunification of East and West Germany, Ploeger listed the challenges that face his country and the United States. In addition to working on developing a European community and helping the economies of Eastern European countries, Ploeger says Germany and the United States need to adapt to the changes themselves and form a better alliance.
Unless we get a new sort of NATO, we would have not been successful in convincing the Russians to accept a united Germany to remain as a united Germany in NATO. And that's what the Germans want. That's what our Western friends and our American friends want. So another thing is, unless we work together in disarmament negotiations to get the amount of armaments decreased in Europe, we will have pretty much more, we would have had pretty much more difficulty to come to terms with the Soviet Union unless they had the expectation of disarmament taking place in Europe and elsewhere. And we will have, and that is a fourth challenge that fits into this all-European picture, we will have to develop a new relationship between East and West, what the American government calls the new European political architecture, what Gorbachev calls the new European home. Whatever you call it, we have to develop that sort of relationship that's not based on confrontation anymore, but rather on cooperation.
Dr. Ploeger says the relationship between the United States and Germany has never been better than it is now, and he sees that as a key to Europe's future.
We want the relationship between Germany and the United States to be a key relationship in the American-European relationship. And we consider this relationship a sort of bridge. And the stronger both pillars are, the stronger the bridge is. And if Germany grows stronger with unification, we will put Germany into Europe. We don't want a German Europe, we want a European Germany. And a European Germany that is stronger will strengthen the European pillar of this Atlantic bridge. And that's what we are working for.
Another of the challenges Ploeger listed is helping the Soviet Union address its economic problems. Ploeger says that will be difficult and will require special solutions. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
The visibility has been down to a mile and slightly less. The humidity that comes along with the rain can reduce the visibility a little bit more and probably make the aerosols a little bit larger. It might be better in a couple of days. The weather service is predicting scattered to numerous showers in the area, so it might clear up a little bit. But I doubt if we'll have unlimited visibility within the next couple of days.
3, 2, 1. An air quality advisory for the interior remains in effect. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's Paul Bateman says that probably won't change.
We are maintaining that advisory, and it'll probably continue until we get sufficient rainfall to bring the forest fires under control or until snow flies, whichever occurs first. There are so many fires in the interior all around Fairbanks that no matter which way the wind is blowing, we're going to be impacted from smoke from those fires. And we expect the density of smoke to vary on a daily basis, depending on humidity and wind and temperature and those kinds of variables, condition of the fire at any given time.
Bateman says rain may be helping a little bit, but the thickness of the smoke varies so much, it's hard to tell whether things are really improving in some areas or not. Until they do, the Fairbanks Clinic is handing out oxygen masks for people who must be outside and are having trouble dealing with the smoke. Clinic Administrator Leonard Olson says they wanted to help.
Conversation that goes on within the building, same people are talking about they're having difficulty breathing. They've got problems with their nose, they've got problems with their eyes, itchiness, redness. It could be from the smoke, it could be from other conditions, but with the problems regarding health, trying to explain to people to stay inside unless they really had to go out, we just thought maybe this was a way we could help.
Dr. Owen Hanley is a Fairbanks physician who specializes in pulmonary disease. Hanley says the smoke shouldn't create any long-term health problems. He says the problem is mainly short-term irritation for susceptible people like those with asthma, and says even his asthma patients aren't having a lot of trouble.
And all of them have said that they had much more trouble when the pollens were out in May than they're having with the smoke now. Maybe that's because those asthma patients are pretty well educated about what they should do. They know how to avoid things that irritate the airway because they have a long history of being exposed to things that irritate the airway. They know when to take their medications and how to take them. So probably a well-educated patient can protect themselves pretty well from environmental hazards because they're used to doing that.
And Dr. Hanley says the smoke is mainly an annoyance for the rest of us.
It's a nuisance. It's an irritant. It's like working with some ammonia or some other acidic substances. It might burn your eyes and nose and throat and irritate your airways, but it is not likely to have a long-term harmful consequence.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Two themes seem to dominate the age in which we live. One is that information is the chief commodity of the post-industrial society, and the second is that of scarce resources. Together, they present good reasons for being on the record and in line. A physician, Shirley Dementev, tribal enrollment officer for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, would like to see all interior natives be in.
We are going around to each of the villages that in our region and doing enrollment so that people, the native people, can be enrolled back to their villages.
Although there is no one pressing reason for those not enrolled to presently do so, looking ahead, there is reason to worry. The health care system the federal government runs for Native Americans may soon need to find a way to limit eligibility. Gerald Ivey, director of the Alaska Native Health Service.
Probably the biggest problem facing the Indian Health Service program is the increasing eligibility. Our population is growing geometrically, and as you may well know, the resources are not keeping up with it. And so it's you know, the population keeps growing, and either it has to be fewer services or fewer people, or you know, there's only so many options when that situation exists.
One option already put forward is to limit Indian Health Service eligibility to enrolled tribal members only. Although that hasn't happened, at the Tanana Chiefs Conference, they're taking no chances. Shirley Dementa.
It doesn't look like they'll do it in the foreseeable future, but they could change, so we're trying to get a jump on something for a change instead of letting things affect us. Getting the work done before it needs to be done, as long as we already started.
There are even more practical reasons for enrolling with a tribe if you live in Bush, Alaska, not the least of which is to be able to identify yourself. Shirley Dementev.
I got our Tanana Chiefs Conference Tribal Enrollment Identification Card approved by the state so that commercial fishermen could use it when they're on the river and Fish and Game comes up and asks to see their ID. They would be able to use these ID cards.
Tanana Chiefs Conference Tribal Enrollment Officer Shirley Dementev, whose job it is to see that the native people of Alaska's 43 interior villages are on the record, lest they be left out. In McGrath, I'm Mike Lane.
3, 2, 1. It will take about $250,000 more for the local agencies to get through the fiscal year. Most agree that number is nearly out of reach, but the borough could dip into its bank account and help out. Chairwoman of the Fairbanks Health and Social Services Commission, Sally Crawford, asked the borough assembly members to do just that.
We have conservatively estimated that every dollar that is going to be put into this community is going to give back $2.50 in service. We've also estimated that if we do not have these services, that the cost to the community just in education alone is going to be somewhere between 15 and 30 times the cost of the block grant monies.
The borough's budget took some hits from the governor, too. Assembly members are concerned about damage they may have to repair internally before taking on a new request like the one from the social service groups. But Brian Rogers, representing the food bank, asked the borough to be part of the solution.
I recognize that you have a number of demands placed on you by the governor's actions and by the fact that his actions took place after you had already set your mill levy for the year, after you've set your budget for the year. And I was extremely disappointed with the governor's actions as they affected the local governments because that you were boxed in. And I think that was much the same case for these agencies. And that's why we're not asking you to solve the complete problem, but just to buy us time to get into the legislative session. Otherwise, groups like the Food Bank, like the Bread Line, like the Crisis Line, the Crippled Children, Hospice, all of these agencies don't have the wherewithal to carry them forward into the legislative session.
Roger says the agencies are all looking at cutting their costs, and groups like the United Way and private firms are helping. Another idea has been pursued by Assemblymember Bonnie Williams, instituting payroll deduction for University of Alaska employees to donate to the charities. Williams says her plan would allow university employees in Fairbanks and Anchorage to voluntarily contribute to the cause.
We would make the donation, whatever employees signed up for, whatever dollar amounts, we would make those donations to the Health and Social Services Commission to distribute to the block grant recipients in proportion to their block grant dollar figures. So if Breadline, for example, had 4.3% of the block grant money in the original legislative thing, then they would get 4.3% of the payroll donations.
Assembly members aren't sure how much help they can offer legally because the borough doesn't have health and social service powers. But a few agency representatives who spoke last night suggested it might be time to pursue that option. Borough Mayor Juanita Helm says the borough can look at what the ordinances on the books provide for and see if there is a way for the borough to help out now. But Helms believes the issue ought to go on the ballot so the community can decide if funding social service agencies is a responsibility it wants to address. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
I just have to pick my fights. I don't veto everything that I think they've done wrong, or I'd be vetoing every other thing that the Assembly does. I just pick the items that I think are the really alarming and blatant violations of our checks and balances and our public opinion system.